and welcome to Episode Center Nation. My name is Brandon Sparks, and today I actually don't have Ben Gertz or Thomas Horton with us. Because of scheduling difficulties, we couldn't get together for this episode, but we do have a very special guest from our, if you've been a listener for Center Nation for a while, and during our first iteration of it, when we were kind of just going kind of crazy with each topic week by week when we were able to record. We have our very own Will Clayton from back then. Will,
how you doing, Brandon? Good to be back.
Good to have you. It's been a bit. It's been almost 2 years since Will was on the show when we took our very long hiatus and we all were searching for answers in our lives. when Ben and Thomas can't come on, hopefully we can have kind of a few one-off episodes like this. We have special guests like Will to talk about stuff. And this episode, because we don't have Ben, we're not going to pitch Ben on movies. Well, we might pitch him a few at the end, but what we're gonna be talking about today, we're gonna be talking about directorial debuts. And what I find so interesting about directorial debuts is that they can be a number of different things for a director. That could be their best film, or when they've like thought about what they've been doing for the longest time and they finally got to put it on screen, or it could be their worst film when they're trying to figure everything out. So we're going to kind of delve into this with three specific filmmakers today. Will, what are your kind of thoughts on directorial debuts?
I would think about it in two ways, because I think there is, especially, there's a separation between directorial debuts of, say, directors pre the year 2000 and then everything since. And I do think it's fun when you study film and film history, as I know that you're an absolute student of film and how the industry has evolved and changed over the years. To me, it's interesting that everything, let's say like that film school generation, the 60s and 70s, their first films that are getting made are vastly different in terms of the first films that are getting made by directors today. So like, for example, let's say Gareth Edwards, for example, right? Like you go from directing one film today and all of a sudden you're given Star Wars or a massive, you know, project to handle. And you've normally been handling something that has a very small budget. And then all of a sudden we slingshot folks to the moon with, you know, $300 million budgets. Whereas pre, you know, 2000s and sort of this current era of the massive franchise films, you know, you had directors that were usually, you know, trying out stories, you know, actually just getting into the groove of what it's like to helm a film. And they usually built them up slowly. You know, you didn't start off with, unless you're, I don't know, even with Spielberg, you don't all start off with, you know, an Indiana Jones type film. You know, you're going to start off small. And they get several films to get into their groove, so to speak. And so to me, it's interesting to sort of see that contrast to today, where a lot of really good small indie directors will make a really well-beloved genre film. And then because that movie made money, we just immediately say, okay, you can handle that. Let's try to let you handle the behemoths, which to me is a little bit interesting and probably kind of ends up sabotaging some folks in the long run, in my opinion.
Yeah, it can. I think with nowadays the franchise makeup, it's like, well, for you mentioned Gareth Edwards. Gareth Edwards went from doing Monsters with Scoot McNairy at like $500,000, and then his next film was Godzilla. The with Aaron Taylor Johnson and Elizabeth Olsen, and then he got Rogue One. Or even you look at Colin Trevorrow, who did Safety Not Guaranteed, and then he bumps up and goes to do Jurassic World. It's Hollywood of late, with at least kind of bigger studio stuff there, they've tried these kind of indie filmmakers to do bigger stuff. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it does not. I think the big one that was kind of, I guess, infamous in a way was like Fantastic Four with Josh Trank, where he does Chronicle and then he does Fantastic Four. And I think sometimes studios might get a younger director like that, who's their second film, and they think it'll be easier to kind of steer them in what they want them to do, in a way. So sometimes that happens. And then sometimes you have like another thing too, with, as I said before, it's like with directors, I also think sometimes a director's best film could be their first film. Because it's just sometimes they've just thought about it so much. I also like it that these director, there's a rawness to their first film. Like, I think you brought up Spielberg. I think Spielberg is his most raw when you look at his like first two films, because he did Duel for, it was a TV movie, but Duel was released in theaters overseas. But Duel was kind of his first movie that kind of got him acclaim, and they did Sugar Land Express. And both of them are, I feel, very different for Spielberg. Still have those kind of little flares of brilliance, but just very raw. And I find that very interesting to see a director do that. And also, I think a good example was recently with Jordan Peele.
Sure.
Where he did Get Out, and I think that's one of the best debuts in a past decade. And he probably had that movie in his head for a very long time, thinking about what he wanted to make. And then when you look at Us, I don't like Us as much as Get Out, but it feels like it was like, someone kind of told me this recently, it was like, Get Out felt like he had 10 years to prep for it, and then with Us, it was like, you have 12 months. And
interesting.
In a way, it feels a little rushed, but what I love about Jordan Peele, what he's doing with the horror genre, or just kind of genre films in general, is that he's swinging for the fences, and even when I didn't really love Us, I liked it, I respect the hell out of like what he's doing within his films.
Sure.
So to bring it back, we'll go, the first guy we want to talk about is Saint Lamette. And Saint Lamette, kind of what I'm saying about the greatest film could be their first film, I think Saint Lamette's greatest film is his first film. And it's possibly one of the greatest American films of all time, and that's 12 Angry Men. And Lamette made close to over 40 movies
right.
in his career, and was directing, I think, up until the last few years of his life. He did Before the Devil Knows You're Dead in 2007, and then he died in 2011. He was 86, so he was in his 80s making movies. 12 Angry Men is just one of the, I think, boldest and just incredibly crafted films of that era. But so Lamette did 12 Angry Men. 12 Angry Men was based on a TV, it was a TV play, a teleplay on CBS before, and then I think it became a play after that. So 12 Angry Men was his first play, or first movie, and Lamette had been directing a lot within theater for a number of years. In the 40s and 50s, he started doing TV in the 50s, and 12 Angry Men was his first movie, and it was produced by Henry Fonda, also stars Henry Fonda. And Fonda and his directing, or his producing partner, picked Lamette out of the theater television circuit and had him direct the film version of 12 Angry Men. And with 12 Angry Men, it's about these, it's a jury is what it is. This young kid has been charged with murdering his father, and the entire movie takes place in the jury room of these 12 men in the 50s discussing if this kid is guilty or not.
Oh, what are we doing now?
I guess we talk.
Boy, oh boy.
You really think he's innocent?
I don't know.
I mean, you sat in court with the rest of us. You heard what we did. The kid's a dangerous killer. You could see it.
He's 18 years old.
Well, that's old enough. He stabbed his own father 4 inches into the chest. They proved it a dozen different ways in court. Would you like me to list them for you?
No. Then what do you want? Just want to talk.
Well, what's there to talk about? 11 men in here think he's guilty. No one had to think about it twice except you.
I want to ask you something. Do you believe his story? I don't know whether I believe it or not. Maybe I don't.
So how come you vote not guilty?
Well, there were 11 votes for guilty. It's not easy to raise my hand and send a boy off to die without talking about it first.
Well, now, who says it's easy?
No one.
Well, just because I voted fast? I honestly think the guy's guilty. Couldn't change my mind if you talked for 100 years.
I'm not trying to change your mind. It's just that we're talking about somebody's life here. We can't decide it in 5 minutes. Supposing we're wrong.
Supposing this whole building should fall down on my head. You can suppose anything.
That's right.
Look, what's the difference how long it takes? Suppose we do it in 5 minutes. So what?
Let's take an hour. Ball game doesn't start till 8 o'clock.
Who's got something to say?
I'm willing to sit for an hour.
Great.
I heard a pretty good story last night.
That's not why we're sitting here.
All right, then you tell me. What are we sitting here for?
I don't know, maybe no reason. Look, this kid's been kicked around all of his life. You know, born in a slum, mother dead since he was 9. He lived for a year and a half in an orphanage when his father was serving a jail term for forgery. It's not a very happy beginning. He's a wild, angry kid. That's all he's ever been. And you know why? Because he's been hit on the head by somebody once a day, every day. He's had a pretty miserable 18 years. I just think we owe him a few words, that's all.
I don't mind telling you this, mister. We don't owe him a thing. He got a fair trial, didn't he? What do you think that trial cost? He's lucky he got it. Know what I mean?
No.
Now look, we're all grown-ups in here. We heard the facts, didn't we? You're not going to tell me that we're supposed to believe this kid, knowing what he is. Listen, I've lived among them all my life. You can't believe a word they say. You know that. I mean, they're born liars.
Only an ignorant man can believe that.
Now, listen.
Do you think you were born with a monopoly on the truth? I think certain things should be pointed out to this man.
Come on, this isn't Sunday. We don't need a sermon.
Come on, we have a job to do now. Let's do it.
Lumet stages this movie very well. And it's something that he became known for throughout his entire career. And there's a specific part in the scene where you have kind of a character get up from the table and walk over to his jacket to get out a handkerchief and kind of sweat, like, dab the sweat off his face. It's very well crafted. And Lumet did this with every one of his films. He rehearsed at least two straight weeks before the filming of the movie. He would, and it started with 12 Angry Men. He would rent out some area, either at like not a warehouse, but at some building, and he would map out the entire sets of his film. And every day, the actors would show up and they would rehearse it for two straight weeks. And I think with 12 Angry Men, it's very apparent, like, that's just a one-room, two-room set. And so I feel like that kind of idea of rehearsing it that much started from this film because it's so contained. I mean, the 12 Angry Men's pretty much done within the jury room and then the bathroom of the jury room. And that's pretty much it. You get one scene inside the courtroom and then one scene outside the courtroom at the very end. And it's never boring. A lot of movies that are based on plays can become boring and feel just kind of like very talky. And Lumet was able to make this film very visual throughout. And in a way, Lumet actually, I didn't realize this till today when researching this, was that Lumet, he did like 45 films and over half of his films were based on plays. And so it makes a little sense of how his idea of what he did in theater early on before this and how this is kind of a very theatrical performance movie. It's interesting to see that carried over throughout most of his films.
What's funny to me is you see this film referenced a lot in this specific scene, redone a lot in pop culture. I remember there being different variations of it played out in, I believe Family Guy did a scene on it several years ago and it served their early runs. And people forget sometimes where the original scene coming from 12 Angry Men. But ultimately, one of the things I do love about it, too, is I could watch Henry Fonda, you know, do just about anything. And so to watch him be this in this character in this film of, you know, he actually seems like a real person, right? In that it's not an actor playing a role. It's legit person. And that's one of the great things about Lumet's work here.
Yeah, Fonda, we talked about, because I don't think you've listened to this episode yet, because I don't think it's come out with time of recording this, but we did an episode on The American Hero, and we talked about Fonda, and how Fonda kind of, in the era, he was this kind of everyman, aw shucks type guy in a way. Like, he wasn't a threat in any way, but because of how he spoke and kind of how he carried himself, he was kind of a speaker for the everyman.
Sure.
But Lumet was able to put together a really great cast of actors for this film. And it's also probably very just inherent in the writing, like I said before, is that I feel like every juror in this movie has a very specific personality. Like, everyone's there for a reason. And Lumet does a good job bringing out the moments for each of their characters throughout the entire film. And again, this is his first movie. He did over 40. And I just think it's his best because of how well thought out it was. It's like a big thing that he did in the movie was, again, with the play, what most people do with a play they're adapting, it's kind of just talky and kind of just shot with coverage of just kind of getting basic shots within the film. And with what Lumet does is he did a very specific thing where when you first start the movie, when you go back and watch it, he starts off most of his stuff looking down at the characters, and he uses very wide angle lenses. And as the movie progresses and the tension builds, he starts going lower with the camera with where he's putting it, and he starts switching it to telephoto lenses, and it becomes more of a close-up. So by the end, you're like just on their eyes. Like, it's just their entire face. When you start off, it's more wide, it's more kind of loose, and then by the end it gets very tight, and the lighting has changed because it's raining outside, so it's gotten darker, it's more contrasty. It's like you're going into hell with how, like, it's just becoming a very dark journey by the end of it. When it first starts off, it's just very kind of like dingy, and then it just becomes a complete dark, almost like a dark nightmare, and almost impressionistic in a way with the way the lighting is done to kind of go with the journey of as these men keep going, and they keep trying to have Fonda's taking one by one, convincing them to go to the innocent side, and the harder people who are more convinced that he's guilty are the ones who become very defensive, and it becomes a very almost like a shouting match between all these characters.
Yes.
But yeah, it became, and with this, because Twilight Young Men deals with kind of some very dark and very, I guess, very, almost dark or dramatic or political topics. That's something that kind of stayed with Lumet throughout most of his career, from doing films like Dog Day Afternoon, with dealing with issues of kind of like class and celebrity. And then you have Pawnbroker, which deals with kind of a Holocaust survivor who's moved to New York and is a jeweler, or is a pawnbroker. And how it deals with the memories of the Holocaust and how it affects them in a present day, to films like The Verdict and how with another courtroom drama. And he did a lot of dark topics. And then he does random things like The Wiz, which feels right. Very offbeat for Lumet, but Lumet was willing to try kind of anything. And he had a very specific process with his directing. And I think because it works so well with 12 Angry Men, it's something he continued to do for the rest of his career. So, yeah, I think Lumet may be one of the most, I won't say underrated. I think people who know him think he's one of the best American directors of all time. But sure. I think in terms of a mainstream thing with most people who are just film goers, they probably don't realize he's probably one of the most underrated American directors of the past 50 years.
Oh, definitely.
So, yeah. And
yeah, it's like you said, I think for maybe folks of our generation younger will probably have never heard of Lumet. And so, again, I think it is useful to try to bring some of these older directors that were previously celebrated. I mean, Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon, Murder on the Orient Express. I mean, in my personal favorite of all of Lumet's films is Network. Mm-hmm. And I totally thought that should have won Best Picture that year when it was nominated. And it's still a film I come back and reference pretty frequently in terms of this is what you can do with storytelling.
Yeah.
And there are so many little moments in that film that are so great. And that's, again, that perfect combination of writer, director, and cast that really brings that film to life. But yeah, I'm a big fan.
Yeah, I know with Network, I know when Aaron Sorkin won the Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for The Social Network, He thanked Patty Chayefsky, who wrote Network. He was just right. Or he didn't thank him. He brought up Network and how like that one for the category, or it may be original screenplay, but he brought that up. I think because Network is a very relevant film even today. That's what's so great about a lot of Lumet stuff is that they've aged. Ones I've seen that I know of have aged really well. Like, you can show 12 Angry Men in a class, because I know law professors just like showing how a jury works sometimes. And you can show Network and how this idea of celebrity and how it's kind of almost what networks and kind of entertainment can do to people. And then the same with even Dog Day Afternoon is how It's essentially a little bit of a Bonnie and Clyde, not Bonnie and Clyde, but it's kind of this like John Dillinger thing where Pacino's a character who, the crowd loves him, and he becomes a celebrity in this midst of this bank robbery, this failed bank robbery. But yeah, I think Lumet's just one of those guys that you could hold up his, you can hold his films up to today's standards and it still be considered a great film.
Absolutely.
So ending on Lumet, let's move on to our next director. Because compare this, Lumet's a guy where this film feels like a lot of his other films where it's in the same kind of canon. And then to move on to a different director who I feel kind of changed a good bit after his first film is a director that Will picked. And Will, who was your pick for today's discussion?
Mel Brooks. And so we're going to be talking about his first movie, The Producers. So Producers, 1967, 1968 time frame. And of course, The Producers was remade and it's been done on stage. They've adapted it since and they've redone it. But to me, this first iteration of The Producers is the best.
I don't disagree with that because I've never saw the. I have seen the musical. I wouldn't disagree. I think Producers is probably one of the greatest. People kind of put up there as one of the greatest American comedies of all time.
It's definitely one that it's one worth considering. The film version, though, I think, because again, it's fairly short. It's a little over 90 minutes, and actually, it might even be shorter than that.
It's 88 minutes. It's very short.
I mean, but it's so tightly done. It brings its point across so well. And I mean, it's Gene Wilder's first film, if I remember too correctly. And or one of his very early films, at least. And it really sort of helped launch him into sort of people's consciousness, being, oh, wow, this guy can do things.
Yeah.
And as a comedy, it's brilliant.
Yeah, and Mel Brooks was coming, he was like Lumet, he was coming from TV, but he was coming from like the writing side of TV. And he was writing on Your Show of Shows, which was a Sid Caesar, who was a big kind of comedian at the time period in the 50s and 60s and probably pre that. But he was known, his show was kind of known for housing a number of great writers. And Mel Brooks was one of them. And he was probably one of their top ones at the time. Your Show of Shows had Carl Reiner, who went on to direct a number of films. Like The Man with Two Brains and The Jerk with Steve Martin. Woody Allen was a writer at that point. I think he worked on specials for Sid Caesar later, but he worked with Sid Caesar. Neil Simon was, I think, a big one who ended up becoming one of the probably the most prolific American playwrights from the 50s onward, and just recently passed away last year, actually. But yeah, or that this year, I think. Is it this year? Earlier this year? So yeah, it's like it was a haven for these kind of comedic geniuses, and Mel Brooks was probably the top one. And so when it came to The Producers, it was a very big deal because it was like it was his first outing into the big boy land of movies. And Brooks still is, I think, from the stuff I've heard of his like interviews, like very just smart and witty mind. Yes. And what's interesting with The Producers, because I read a book on the editor of The Producers, Ralph Rosenblum. And funny enough, he was the editor for The Producers for Mel Brooks. He was also editor for Sidney Lumet for a number of Sidney Lumet's earlier films as well. And this is kind of true. Like everyone's kind of agreed with this, and maybe even Mel Brooks, I'm not entirely sure. But Mel Brooks was so, I guess, nervous because it was his first movie. He was very insecure and very, what's the word? He got angry a lot, apparently, because he was coming from a world of TV where everything moved really fast. And with movies, they don't move as fast. At the time of The Producers, he kind of lacked the knowledge of filmmaking. So he made a lot of mistakes on set they had to like figure out in the editing room. And Ralph Rosenblum never worked with Mel Brooks again after this movie because of how much they clashed while editing it. And I know if you look at the Wikipedia page, whatever, do some research, is that you'll see like The assistant director talked about how it was he kind of Brooks would have tantrums and behave angrily on set, and he got impatient because of the how quick television was and films were so slow. He even got into like arguments with Zero Mostel, who played the lead of the movie basically as Max Bialystock, the producer. So yeah, but let's break this down. What's the premise of the producers? I don't think we described, or we didn't explain what the producers is about.
Sure. I mean, so ultimately, the producers is it's actually kind of doing two things, really. First, it's the story in and of itself is a down on his luck, shyster, corrupt producer of Broadway plays. Not necessarily Broadway, but plays in general, is having some financial troubles. And this young accountant is sent to look at his books. And through the course of him looking at his books, offers up this idea that it turns out you could actually defraud a bunch of people, theoretically, by, say, raising a bunch of extra money for your show than you need. And then if the show doesn't play, you could pocket all the money. And so then the idea then became, let's find let's try to put on and produce a play that we know will absolutely bomb. So then we can pocket all the money and then go to Rio and live out our fantasies in South America. And so it's really, it's kind of a buddy comedy of sorts. But it's also satirizing in general how producing stage plays also kind of works as well, that all of the ins and outs of raising capital, finding backers, finding shows, finding actors, and then putting on the thing. It's sort of a behind the scenes a little bit, obviously with a much more satirical and comedic bent to it.
Amazing. It's absolutely amazing. But under the right circumstances, a producer could make more money with a flop than he could with a hit. Yes, it's quite possible. If he were certain that the show would fail, a man could make a fortune.
Yes?
Yes, what?
What you were saying. Keep talking.
What was I saying?
You were saying that under the right circumstances, a producer could make more money with a flop than he could with a hit.
Yes, it's quite possible.
You keep saying that, but you don't tell me how. How can a producer make more money with a flop than he could with a hit?
Well, it's simply a matter of creative accounting. Let's assume, just for the moment, that you are a dishonest man.
Assume away.
It's very easy. You simply raise more money than you really need.
What do you mean?
Well, you did it yourself, only you did it on a very small scale.
What'd I do?
You raised $2,000 more than you needed to produce your last play.
So what? What did it get me? I'm wearing a cardboard belt.
Well, that's where you made your mistake. You didn't go all the way. You see, if you were really a bold criminal, you could have raised $1 million.
But the play cost me only $60,000 to produce.
And how long did it run?
One night.
You see? Do you see what I'm trying to tell you? You could have raised $1 million, put on a $60,000 flop, and kept the rest.
But what if the play was a hit?
Well, then you'd go to jail. Oh. See, once the play's a hit, you have to pay off all the backers. And with so many backers, there could never be enough profits to go around. Get it?
Uh-huh. So in order for this scheme to work, we'd have to find a surefire flop.
What scheme?
What scheme? Your scheme, you bloody little genius.
I meant no scheme. I merely posed a little academic accounting theory. It was just a thought.
Bloom, worlds are turned on such thoughts. Don't you see, Bloom, darling Bloom, glorious Bloom? It's so simple. Step one, we find the worst play in the world, a surefire flop. Step two, I raise $1 million. A lot of little old ladies in the world. Step three, you go back to work on the books. Phony list of backers, one for the government, one for us. You can do it, Bloom. You're a wizard. Step four, we open on Broadway. And before you can say step five, we close on Broadway. Step six, we take our $1 million, we fly to Rio de Janeiro. Rio by
Mr.
the Rouse, sea.
Oh, wait a minute. Rouse,
oh, please, mio. Wait, oh, my.
You're holding me too tight.
Rio. Rio by the sea. Oh, me.
I'm an honest man. You don't understand.
No, Bloom, you don't understand. This is fate. This is destiny. This is kismet. There's no avoiding it.
Mr. Bialystock, not more than 5 minutes ago, I doctored your books. That, sir, is the ultimate extent of my criminal life.
Whoa! I want that money!
Oh, I fell on my keys.
And that's the plot of the producers, guys.
What makes it funnier, though, is, of course, you know, being, you know, Mel Brooks being Jewish, he decides to make fun of the Nazis throughout the rest of the film, because they pick to put on a little show called Springtime for Hitler, and were originally written by an actual legitimate Nazi in praise of Hitler. And the idea was, we're going to put on a show that is so pro-Nazi it will offend everyone's sensibilities. But then it turns out the guy they get to play Hitler is so funny and entertaining, the entire audience who is turning on the play decides they're going to stick around and watch it, because to them it looks like a farce.
Yeah.
And it's just the layers to this are fantastic.
Yeah, because I think the big switch, I think in the original movie, it's like a hippie, like flower child type guy that plays Hitler. And then when I know they switched it to the musical and the film adaptation of the musical, it's the kind of flamboyantly gay director who becomes Hitler at the end.
Yes.
So it's a very interesting change from the 60s version to the present day, or the more modern version. But yeah, so the interesting about the producers, like, it's originally the person that was going to play Leo Bloom, the one they offered it to was Peter Sellers. Peter Sellers never got back to them. And Sellers was known for, like, the Pink Panther series, and he was probably one of the biggest British comedians, film comedians of that era. Probably one of the greatest of all time, in a way, in terms of, like, sound films. And then it was cast as Dustin Hoffman for Leo Bloom, and he was in it, and he was like, hey, he asked Brooks to, like, if he could get out of the movie so he could audition for The Graduate. And when he got The Graduate, Mel Brooks let him go. And the funny part is that Mel Brooks' wife at the time was Anne Bancroft, and she was in The Graduate. So it was just kind of, it's very, very small world. But that's how they got, and then it wound up being Gene Wilder, who would essentially start a very prolific career as an actor and writer with Mel Brooks, from Blazing Saddles to Young Frankenstein. The big thing I want to ask you is, like, so what, compared to his entire filmography, how is the producers the same, and how is it different from Mel Brooks's filmography?
Well, really, what's interesting to me, because what Brooks has only made, let's see, what, maybe 10 films? 11, 12 total? To me, when you look at Brooks's career, that early part of his career, and I'm talking producers, 12 Chairs, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, Silent Movies in there somewhere, and High Anxiety, like, those first four or five films, I think, are great in that they're all parodies, but they're not going purely for to give you a comparison for today. Scary Movie, the Scary Movie franchise of, you know, doing send-ups of classic horror films, not even necessarily classic, but just horror films of their age.
Yeah.
His early films for Mel Brooks were legitimately not only send-ups of the genre films that he's doing, but were actually worthy genre films of the genre he's doing in their own right, albeit with his own sort of comedic little take on it. And so with those first five especially, really you can say that change after High Anxiety. I love History of the World Part One, personally, but I would think if you want to make that cutoff after High Anxiety, it's when he just starts going into, let's just kind of do more slapstick silly.
Yeah.
And, but those early films though, especially Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, and what he's doing is he's really trying to show not only his appreciation and love for Hollywood and Hollywood films and history, of these different genres. He's doing the same thing with the producers, except this, he's not talking about Hollywood. He's talking about Broadway. And Mel Brooks, growing up in New York, loved the stage, loved vaudeville, loved everything about Broadway and show production. Mm-hmm. And so this was his version of a love letter to Broadway as a concept. And so you're going to these concept films, really, ultimately his first early part of his work. And then, right, again, you can make the argument maybe after History of the World, maybe Spaceballs is the one where it really starts to kind of go down in terms of quality. But those first five, he's really just showing how much he appreciates the history and the craft of these classic Hollywood stories.
Yeah. No, I think, I agree with that. And I think also interesting, in most of the genre films post-producers, I don't know about that, but like with Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein and Silent Movie, he's taking old genres that aren't as prevalent at the time. Like Blazing Saddles, it's a Western. That really kind of died out in like the 50s. The type right. of Western they're making fun of kind of died out in the 50s. Young Frankenstein is a spoof on 1930s horror films, Universal horror films. Silent Movie, it's in the title. High Anxiety is a take on Alfred Hitchcock movies. Yeah. And I think then we get to Spaceballs, it feels more like, it, in a way, it's too modern. Because they're essentially ripping on...
It's just Star Wars.
Star Wars in 2001 and a couple... But mainly Star Wars. So, like, then... And then he tries to get back into the old genre with Robin Hood of kind of this, like, swashbuckler-type tale. But I think the producers, though... Because the producers feels... It's a comedy and it's a satire. It doesn't feel as much of a spoof parody. Because spoof is kind of the title he called these films... It doesn't feel as much of a spoof as his later ones do.
Sure.
Like, this feels more like just a satirical comedy, and in a way, probably more mainstream for the time. It was a good debut for this type of his, because it's not full on Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, like kind of like obscure or absurd comedy, but it's bordering. The Nazi stuff is very the big like push of the envelope, I guess you could say.
Sure.
Because of it was only like 20 years after World War II. It's a really good debut. Even though when you hear about the struggles they had on set, it kind of makes sense when you watch the movie. Like if he had struggles with the cinematographer. The Producers isn't really that well shot to me. Put it in comparison between this and 12 Angry Men, which is what we watched.
Sure.
And this comes out 10 years afterwards. It's very like just kind of bland, but it works for the comedy. Like everyone kind of thinks comedy just needs to be kind of just evenly lit and nothing too crazy. And it makes sense for the producers. And I do think it's probably one of the best comedies of that era. And it's also at a point, it's coming out when New Hollywood is beginning to take over. So The Producers is an interesting mix of like an old Hollywood type, like kind of filmmaking, but it's in the midst of like Bonnie and Clyde when younger filmmakers are attacking at that point. I didn't realize that until now. It's released at a very interesting time period in film history when there's about to be a shift.
Yes.
And in a way, Brooks is kind of taking these old school style things and putting a more modern kind of 60s, 70s spin on it all.
Yeah, perhaps my term for McCall, let me clarify. I didn't mean to say that The Producers is a genre film. Obviously, the next five in the series are more specifically genre films. But what I'm trying to communicate is that love letter sort of idea to these older things, you really start to see that there at The Producers, but definitely The Producers is the most unique of all of his, because it can't really be a great comparison to any of his other films because they're all essentially spoofs.
Yeah. This one's less so. And well, again, it's like you said, it's more of a love. They're all love letters, but this is very much so because Brooks was from New York. He was from Brooklyn. And he loved Broadway shows. I don't know if he went to them that much, but they like at least listened to them if they could. But yeah, it's like, this is very much in a weird way, it's a very personal film, which is very important for like a first-time filmmaker, is that you need to kind of make a more personal film for your... But definitely. It's a personal film in his context of comedy. But it definitely establishes this kind of Mel Brooks... style and tone, but it isn't as amplified as it will later become with Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein. He knew that he was kind of known more for comedies. Like he did a lot of things in the 70s and 80s when in terms of like producing and stuff that was not in his usual realm of of expertise or known for. Like, he produced, I mean, he was a big part of getting David Lynch into the mainstream.
Yeah, because, with Elephant Man.
With Elephant Man, because he saw Eraserhead at a theater in L.A. I was like, hey, this guy's pretty good. And he established his Brooks Film banner because he never put his name as a producer on a lot of these films because he was afraid that audiences would always think it was a comedy because his name was on there.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But it did such films as like The Fly with David Cronenberg, The Elephant Man. So he was able to bring kind of these more auteur filmmakers into the mainstream. Brooks has always had a great taste in stuff. And he's been very he's used his power as a way to kind of bring in these auteur directors, and or at least in the 80s at that time. So you talked about, I want to ask this question because it's kind of come up in my regular life of late, and I've kind of seen it out in the media. You're talking about how Brooks is doing these kind of love letters to these genres. If you're doing a genre film,
uh-huh,
do you think you have to love it in order to make a film in that genre?
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
I think it works better if you do.
Okay.
Ultimately, genre films, if you're going to make a genre film, I would ask, are you, number one, are you making a commentary on the genre film? Like, because there have been different takes on that, right? You know, we've seen the self-aware horror films, you know, your Screams or your, especially Cabin in the Woods, you know, where
yeah,
it's a genre film, but also breaking down and commenting on the genre it's making. I wouldn't necessarily call Cabin in the Woods a love letter, so to speak, but there's definitely an appreciation for horror as a genre.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can make films, even if you don't necessarily like a genre, you can make a genre film and be about a genre you personally didn't care for. But as long as you can show that you understand the genre which you're making, I think that's the more important part. Do you actually understand what it is you're talking about?
Because I haven't seen this yet, but like The Dead Don't Die, which is a zombie film that Jim Jarmusch released this year, and I heard him say how like, oh, he hates zombie films, and I was just kind of like, then why do you make a zombie film? And so it's I think that's a good point, is that if you're making a comment on the genre, and if you, because you can, there, I feel like sometimes you have to love an aspect of it to kind of comment on it. But I feel like if you really hate it, I'm not sure how you can bring a good, like, I don't know how you can put your stamp on that genre if you truly hate that genre.
Right.
Because I feel like if you hate that genre, the question is, do you fully understand it?
Right.
Because if you're like, oh, I just watched these five movies, and I'm not saying this is Jim Jarmusch, I'm just saying it's in general with people. If you're like, oh, I watched these five movies, I hate those films, I'm going to make one that's like that's going to like be my version of that. And I'm like, well, I don't know if that really works, but okay. So it's interesting because I think Brooks proves if you really love the genre and you know that much about it, then you can actually riff on it more and it'll be more, I guess, impactful, by the end of it.
Definitely.
And in a way too, because of that, I think it holds up more. I mean, Young Frankenstein, I think, is still a masterpiece. And in a way, that's when you're talking about where it feels like it's just a horror, like it's like a horror. Like, I saw Young Frankenstein before I saw Frankenstein. And so when I see stuff in Frankenstein, I'm like, oh, that's like the Gene Hackman character in Young Frankenstein. Like, it's like, it really hits the beats of that genre incredibly well. But in parts, because not all of it's played for laughs. I mean, I think, like, when Gene Wilder's, like, finally accepting that he's a Frankenstein, that's not really funny. Like, it's just, to me, it's not. Like, it just feels like, oh, he's a Frankenstein now. He's just following the story structure or whatever. Or his character development. It makes sense. That's my favorite of his. But, yeah, Producers kind of establishes that that style and that tone for Brooks, and it would win Best Original Screenplay at the Oscars the year it came out, and so it basically put Mel Brooks on the map in terms of film, and kind of, even with all the conflict and struggles on set, it didn't matter by the end of it, because if it does well when it's released, it does well, and you can't really change that most times. So moving on to our last person, we're going to kind of go through real quick, because Will, we were just going to do these two, but Will pitched this idea of talking about a third director, who I think we can both talk about, who's a very, more of a modern, he's a modern filmmaker, and it's his career has been very interesting in the way it's gone over the past years, and that's Tim Burton. So Will, why did you want to talk about Tim Burton today?
Well, when you originally pitched this idea of looking at directors and their debuts, I was trying to go back and finding, number one, not just directors I like, but also a film that I'd either seen recently or a film that I knew I could at least talk about, and then try to see if there's comparison. So I originally thought about maybe the Coen brothers and talking about Blood Simple, but I know we've discussed Blood Simple before on the show in the past, and I didn't want to be self-referential, so to speak, but I've kept thinking about Tim Burton. And the reason I kept thinking about Tim Burton is, I don't know about you, but I am a big, big fan of the film Ed Wood. And I forget that Ed Wood came after Beetlejuice and after Batman. And because to me, Ed Wood feels almost like that quiet first film that a director would put out there. Because I think if you're a fan of movies and movie making, you're probably familiar with Ed Wood.
Yeah.
But you might not necessarily, in the broader scheme of the pop culture, know what Ed Wood is. But then I go back and I'm like, oh, wait, Pee-wee's Big Adventure was his first film.
Yeah.
And that's such a wonderfully fun, odd, quirky little film and story from a director that is known for more of his visual aesthetic, I guess, is what he's most known for today. But I do think you start to see, again, I think his career post-Mars Attacks is very up and down.
Yeah.
And but everything beforehand has that sort of charm to it. And I think Pee-wee's Big Adventure is a very charming film.
Yeah, so with Tim Burton, because what was interesting, because I pitched this idea to you, and also Hunter. Hunter was going to, another guy from our earlier iteration of this podcast was going to come on, but he also couldn't make it because of scheduling stuff. But I realized how, like, when you guys were kind of pitching ideas off directors, the films you thought of were, like, the second or third film by that director.
Right.
It was, like, I think, like, you talked about David Fincher, and you're like, well, that's Alien 3. Is that really is that really a David Fincher film?
Right.
No, it's like more like The Game might be more of a Fincher film, which was, I think, his follow up to that.
Yes.
Seven was his follow up, I think. Anyway,
I think you're right. Yeah,
I think it was Seven. So that feels like more of like that's a Fincher film. And I think a couple others were brought up as well, where it's like you. I was even looking at certain people where I was like, oh, I was thinking about Ron Howard at one point. Because I was like, oh, Night Shift. Night Shift's the one I really know. And like, that feels like a first-time film where it's like a comedy and it's like it doesn't feel like a Ron Howard movie that it became, his career became. But I was like, wait, he made like two movies before that and I haven't even seen those. So it's like things like that where you don't realize kind of they don't really find their footing to a few movies in sometimes. They're not always like Sandy Lumet or Mel Brooks where they hit it right out of the gate and you get their vision, you get their idea. And with Tim Burton, I've always found it fascinating that he did Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Like, it kind of makes sense, but also doesn't. Like,
sure.
it's a very odd movie. And some people would describe a lot of Burton's films as odd movies. But it feels so... Burton doesn't really dabble in like slapstick comedy, and Pee-wee is a slapstick comedy to me. It's a very off the wall comedy and film. And so what's give us the breakdown of Pee-wee's Big Adventure real quick.
Well, you can't talk about Pee-wee without talking about the character in Paul Reubens, right? So originally Pee-wee, it's this character played by actor and comedian Paul Reubens. That's this very childlike, silly, quirky adult man that acts like he's about 8 to 12 years old, maybe. You could even go younger in some respect. He lives in a very colorful house. People might be familiar with him from Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Mm-hmm.
But it always had sort of a in the earliest iterations of Pee-wee had a bit of a ribald and maybe a little bit racy, a little sort of somewhat sexual kind of perverse undertones to it a little bit here and there. But the character became popular sort of with, I believe, sort of late night television crowds, and particularly, you know, colleges. And I remember my dad talking about when he was in college, discussed how much that Pee-wee was a big hit with, you know, the fraternity crowd and whatnot. They just thought the character was so much fun. And because the character is so bizarre and out there, how would that character live? And what would that character be like outside of his house? And so that's really where Pee-wee's Big Adventure comes in, where he has a bicycle. And it's not just a bicycle. It's going to be a ridiculous Pee-wee bicycle, because everything he does is over the top and colorful and strange. And if I remember correctly, the writer for this wasn't Phil Hartman.
Phil Hartman. Which I didn't realize until just looking this up that Phil Hartman was a co-writer on this film.
And that to me is really funny too, because he does the voiceover of the news film, or the news guy, I believe, in the movie, which most people know Phil Hartman from SNL and mm-hmm. from his voiceover work both on The Simpsons. And Phil Hartman's one of my favorite comedic voices in terms of actual voices. When you get to hear, you say, "Oh, that's Phil Hartman." And so it's an interesting little film like that. And so ultimately, Pee-wee's bicycle gets stolen, mm-hmm. and Pee-wee then goes on this grand big adventure to go find and get his bicycle back. Mm-hmm. And the characters that he runs into along the way in his journey across America, that's really the heart of the film. And it's this character meeting and connecting with other quirky, interesting characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm reading up a little bit on it. So it was a 90-minute film. It was a 90-page script. Basically, they took Sid Field's screenplay book, and they're like, "We wrote this script as faithful to what the book said." So it's like, on page 30, I lose the bike. On page 60, I find it. It's like, it's just, and he was like, "We need a MacGuffin. It's going to be my bike." And apparently he originally, Paul Reubens wanted to remake Pollyanna with Pee-wee Herman as the Haley Mills character. And then he's like, I noticed everyone at Warner Brothers had a bike. And I was like, so I requested a bike, and that's what inspired the script.
That's hilarious.
So Burton, to give context about Tim Burton on this project, Tim Burton was working at Walt Disney Studios. He was an animator for a number of years. He came out of Cal Arts, which was kind of the school for Disney animators at that point. And he did a couple short films there. It was Vincent, which was kind of this take on this young kid who loved Vincent Price and pretends to act like Vincent Price. And then he did another short called Frankenweenie, which is basically like, it's a Frankenstein story, but it's his dog is what it is. It's this young boy experiments in science, and like his dog dies and he brings it back to life. Disney later turned it into a feature film about 7 years ago now, an animated film. So what's funny to me is that Burton had a massive falling out with Disney at that time, and was very unhappy with them. And he left. He's like, "I want to direct a feature now." And because Paul Reubens and them saw Vincent and Frankenweenie, Burton was hired for that. That's the context of Burton getting the job. Let's give you a scene real quick from Pee-wee's Big Adventure. So, Will, what's going to happen in this scene, kind of the context that we need to know as we jump into this?
Okay, so in this particular scene, Pee-wee is meeting his neighbor, Francis, and Francis really wants Pee-wee's bicycle. And so Pee-wee is taking his bicycle out of his house, and you get to see this incredibly colorful house that Pee-wee lives in, and he's just going to ride his bike, and his neighbor Francis comes across the street, and Pee-wee and Francis don't get along, and Francis is talking about how much he wants to buy and own Pee-wee's bicycle.
Morning, Pee-wee.
Look, Francis.
Today is my birthday, and my father said I can have anything I want.
Good for you and your father.
So guess what I want?
A new brain.
No, your bike. Oh, what's so funny, Pee-wee?
It's not for sale, Francis.
My father says everything's negotiable.
Pee-wee, I wouldn't sell my bike for all the money in the world. Not for $100 billion, $1 million, trillion dollars.
Then you're crazy.
I know you are, but what am I?
You're a nerd.
I know you are, but what am I?
You're an idiot.
I know you are, but what am I?
I know you are, but what am I? I know you are, but what am I?
I know you are, but what am I?
I know you are, but what am I?
I know you are, but what am I? Infinity.
No, I'm not. You are.
No
way. Knock it off.
Cut it out.
Shut up, Pee-wee.
Why don't you make me?
Why don't you make me?
Because I don't make monkeys. I just train them.
Oh, Pee-wee, listen to reason. Come on!
I'm listening to reason.
Pee-wee!
That's my name. Don't wear it out.
Remember the first time I saw your bike? You were riding past my house, and I came running out to tell you how much I liked it even way back then?
I love that story.
You'll be sorry, Pee-wee Herman!
This is such an odd movie. Like, I haven't seen this probably in a decade, if I had to guess. And now I want to rewatch it. It's so weird.
Yes.
It makes sense that Tim Burton did it, but you're just, off the top of your head, you're like, hey, he didn't do that. It's just, oh, man, that's such a, oh, gosh.
Well, let's just think about it for a second. That movie. So as soon as he does Pee-wee, the next thing he does in terms of big films is Beetlejuice. I mean, yeah. Like, come on! It's such a. It's not that much of a leap, but it is kind of a leap though in comparison.
Yeah, it is. But it makes sense. Like, and it's a 3-year gap between Pee-wee and Beetlejuice, and then he just goes on a crazy run of Beetlejuice, Batman, Edward Scissorhands, Batman Returns. Produces Night Before Christmas, directs Ed Wood, and then you have Mars Attack, which is probably the kind of misstep. And then and I think when Mars Attack happens is when it starts, like, it's kind of hit or miss for a bit.
Right.
And
Sleepy Hollow
I like. Planet of the Apes I don't like. Big Fish I love. I'm not too keen on his next two films, which is Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Corpse Bride. I like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory more than most people do. But yeah, it's a very... When looking at his entire career, I say up until Frankenweenie, when he... I think Big Eye... When he gets to Big Eyes, that's where it gets kind of weird. But everything feels within Tim Burton genre. There's a few films here, and Pee-wee is kind of one that feels like it's... From a visual standpoint, it feels like it's on the outskirts of what the Burton visual style is. I don't think you fully get to see Tim Burton's, like, German expressionism stuff until Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
And then more so into, like, Edward Scissorhands and Batman Returns. Batman Returns is when Burton goes full Burton. Like,
that's true.
That's where, like, when, in terms of visual stuff, it's full on Tim Burton. He's bordering on it with each film he does, and it keeps pushing it farther and farther. Edward Scissorhands is probably the most, like, Burton-esque story in a way. Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Jesus. That's, like, one of the weirdest debuts to me, honestly.
It's a bizarre one, definitely. Yeah. I mean, that it doesn't necessarily fit, but one of the reasons I did think about this film, though, and the reason I like that clip we used is, again, we talked about how Burton is considered such a visual filmmaker. He has a visual style. Everyone knows, like you said, his German expressionism.
Yeah.
You can just think about Beetlejuice with the giant snake and the snake heads and everything he does with that, his sense of color. But he does have a very strong sense of color as well in most of his films. Even the darker, you know, more drab looking sort of tonal films, you know, I actually like parts of Dark Shadows. I think it actually kind of works more than it doesn't work.
Dark Shadows is starting to get a following, I've noticed. Like, a lot of people, it's either hit or miss with a lot of people. They either love it or hate it.
Yeah, and it's one of those, and again, what makes that film so funny to me is that did anyone care about the original Dark Shadows, the teleplay / soap opera that was hardly remembered from the early 60s? I mean, yeah. Other than Tim Burton, but it's such a Tim Burton thing to do, to go grab this random thing and let's just basically redo it, but we're gonna put my visuals on it.
Yeah.
And but that's the thing, though. Like, there's a lot of color even within Dark Shadows.
Yeah, very much so.
And Pee-wee's house, if you go back and watch this scene in this sequence, there's so much color in his house. I mean, there's greens, blues, bright color is filled through the whole thing. And of course, Paul Rubens' character in the gray suit, white shirt, and the little red bow tie that he's known for. But the entire film is filled with color. Mm-hmm. And from that standpoint, I do think you start to see that Burton really does like bright visual. He wants your eye to be drawn to certain things. And from that perspective, I think it is really kind of neat to sort of see this, even in this really, really early film that doesn't seem to relate to his other stuff. No, you start to see little elements of it here and there.
Well, the big scene that pops out to me as a Tim Burton type scene is the large Marge character.
Yes.
And what they do with, like, her eyes pop out or something, I believe is what it is. It's been so long. But, like, it's a very, like, dark and, like, weird scene. And that feels like the most Tim Burton's scene that I remember of the film.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's...
Large Marge.
Yeah. I mean, but think about the other stuff that happens in that film, right? It's just, you know, he goes to the Alamo, takes a tour through the Alamo, like, just randomly. I mean, it's... there are things that happen in this film that just... that feel very Burton-esque in that he has that certain sense of... he has an appreciation for the weird.
Yeah.
And Large Marge, of course, is probably the best in terms of the weirdness in this already weird film. And it's definitely... even with Mars Attacks, there's a certain amount of playfulness throughout all of his films.
Yeah.
Even though I didn't see Dumbo when it was out, I'm not sure if it was still there or not. But at least from the trailers of Dumbo, I did get that sense of sort of whimsy and feel that a lot of his earlier films had.
Yeah. And the other thing that Pee-wee Herman's Big Adventure started was it started his collaboration with Danny Elfman. Danny Elfman, Burton was a big fan of Elfman's musical group Oingo Boingo. And Elfman, he asked Elfman to provide the music. And Elfman's done every one of his films except Ed Wood, Sweeney Todd, and Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. But yeah, it's like it started off his... so in a way, it started off his collaboration with Elfman. So you're seeing kind of little strands of what became Tim Burton. But it wasn't fully materialized yet. It's one of the... it's a debut that shows how a director doesn't fully grasp their style... their first try out, and it takes them a few tries to get there.
Absolutely.
So yeah, we've covered a lot with these three films. We've gone from Saint Lamette with jury and courtroom dramas, and then we go from to producers about the producers putting on a Nazi musical called Springtime for Hitler, and then we're here at Pee-wee Herman's Big Adventure with Tim Burton. All three films, I think, showcase the director's style or voice in some way. And besides Many 12 Angry Men, with producers and Pee-wee's Big Adventure, it showcases two directors who haven't fully grasped just what they can do yet within film. And now it's our segment for Pitch Ben, but Ben's not here. And Ben hasn't seen either or any of these three films.
He's not seen all three, okay.
To my knowledge... according to his Letterboxd, 12 Angry Men's on his watch list, and he hasn't marked Pee-wee's Big Adventure or The Producers. I doubt he's watched The Producers, just from me knowing Ben. He might have seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure, but I'm not positive. So out of these three, which one would you pitch to Ben, Will?
I'm pitching Pee-wee.
okay.
Just because it's so out there and it's so strange. And I think Ben might find it might fit his sensibilities a little bit in terms of the playfulness and the silliness.
And he has he has kids. Hopefully he can show his kids Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
I think it could work. I think he might appreciate it.
Okay, I'll pitch him 12 Angry Men because he needs to see 12 Angry Men. Because I'm just like, how have you not seen this, Ben? So yeah, that's all I really have for today. Again, Will, thank you so much for coming on. I've kind of been playing with this idea of directorial debuts for a while now, and it's a good kind of hopefully break from when we do these subgenres, and hopefully we can do more. So yeah, guys, thank you so much for listening. Make sure you... anything else you want to say, Will, before we get to the end?
Hey, I'm just glad. Thanks for having me back, man. I appreciate
Thank you. But so, yeah, guys, make sure you follow us on Apple Podcast. Give us a review or rating. We really, that's beneficial to us. It helps us kind of figure out what you guys like about the show. And hopefully people will discover us from those reviews and those ratings. Make sure you listen to us on Spotify if that's your choice of podcast listening. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Will, thank you again for coming on. And thank you guys for listening. Bye.